Is it possible to be gay and atheist? On today's show, we have Greta Christina, a former Peep Show dancer and now a blog evangelist for atheism. Greta's here to talk with us about living a fabulous life outside of religion and why you'd be better off thinking of Jesus as Santa Claus.
Why are so many gay and lesbian people wrapped up in religion all of a sudden? What do all the world's religions and philosophies share in common? And why are atheists so goddamn angry?
Greta's also the editor of several great new books, including Paying for It, A Guide by Sex Workers for Their Clients. The book showcases essays written by real-life sex workers who dispel some common misconceptions on why people pay for sex.
We also take a look at ways you can make the most out of your experience with a sex worker, whether they're a dancer at a bar or someone you spend the night with.
Get ready for an arousing and illuminating conversation with Greta Christina. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Villian.
And this is Feast of Fools. Hallelujah. Today's show is made possible by generous support of fantastic listeners like you.
We really can't do this show without your support, so please visit our website, feastoffools.net, and make a donation or buy a fabulous new t-shirt.
Your contributions make the show possible.
Thank you.
Subscribe to the Feast of Fools podcast on the iTunes Music Store and never miss a delicious show.
Just type in Feast of Fools in the search bar and hit subscribe.
Hello? Hi, Greta Christina. This is Fausto Fernos.
And Mark Villian from the Feast of Fools podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing?
Wonderful, wonderful. Welcome to the show.
I've been enjoying looking at your blog so much and your book.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
So you write a lot about atheism.
I do.
Is it possible to be gay and an atheist?
Absolutely. There's certainly no contradiction there. I mean, atheist just means you don't believe in God, and it doesn't care what sexual orientation you are.
So what do you believe in? The power of love?
Well, it's interesting when you say, what do you believe in? I mean, basically, you know, you can say what I believe in terms of my inspirations and my ideals. I believe in, you know, love. I believe in people getting along. I believe in certainly the power of people sitting down and talking about things. If you want to talk in terms of my atheism, what I believe is that what there is the physical world, and that that's all there is. I don't believe that there's any God. I don't believe there's any spirit or soul. I don't believe in any metaphysical energy. I believe.
Well, how do you celebrate Christmas?
Yeah.
I actually just wrote a piece about celebrating Christmas. You know, I celebrate Christmas because it's cold and it's dark and we need to party.
We need the light.
We need light. We need food. We need drink. We need to hang out.
And you recently wrote an essay on being an atheist and being queer. And is it difficult to be atheist and queer?
You know, sometimes it is, and that's something that's changed. I came out over 20 years ago, and when I first came out in the, you know, mid to late 80s, the queer community was not as all that religious.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first came out, in fact, there was a lot of criticism of religion. There was a lot of hostility towards, you know, religion. And it seems as if lately, in the last few years, the queer community has become more religious, both more in terms of the traditional religions like Christianity and Judaism, and also in terms of sort of New Age woo-woo religions.
I would also argue that it's also becoming part of the gay lesbian experience and politics too.
Yes,
like this week, Obama announced that this Episcopalian gay bishop is going to be doing his incantation or something. I didn't realize there was an incantation to become a president.
It was the opening prayer to start off the whole festivities, which happens 2 days before the actual inauguration. He's not actually at the inauguration.
It's not at the inauguration. It's at the pre show.
It's the shut those homosexuals up show.
But yes, no, that's true. What I've noticed is that a lot of LGBT political people are talking a lot more about we need to make more common cause with the religious groups, you know, I don't really have a problem with that, but they also need to recognize that non-believers exist as well. If they're going to do outreach to the churches and the synagogues, they also need to do outreach to the secular and godless communities.
Greta, do you think this is a consequence of progress? Why is this happening now?
Part of it is that a lot of people were brought up religious, but of course they were brought up mostly in religions that were very hostile to being lesbian, gay, bi, trans. But if you're brought up religious, that can still be very important to you. And I think a lot of people find this sense of home if they can find a gay-positive church or synagogue or other religious group. And I suspect also that AIDS has a lot to do with it. I think that if you have a lot of people in your community who are sick and dying, then a lot of people turn to religion to find some comfort in that. Mainstream America is religious. And as the gay community becomes more part of the mainstream world and the mainstream political world, a lot of that is very tied up with religion.
Do you think it's a waste of time for a lot of these civil rights, gay civil rights leaders to be making the outreach to the church when they should be focusing on laws? Because laws are actually what protects people. The church really doesn't have any legal standing, or shouldn't.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I do think that we should be mostly focusing on policy. I do think that it's not completely ridiculous to try to get progressive religious organizations involved on our side, just because that's who's going to counter the anti-gay religion. You know, if you have, you know, the Mormon Church and the Catholic Church who are screaming about how terrible it is that same-sex couples can get married, it does provide a useful counterweight to that to have progressive religions saying, hey, we don't believe that, just because it takes their moral authority away. It points up to the idea,
right,
that you can't prove what God wants. You don't have any evidence that God wants what you want. You know, other religious believers think that God wants something else, so what right do you have to try to force your religious beliefs down everybody else's throat? So I think that in terms of the public debate, it's not completely ridiculous to get progressive religious groups on our side, but I do think that when we do that, we also need to acknowledge the fact that we're a society that separates church and state, in theory at least,
mm-hmm,
and that we shouldn't be trying to legislate religion at all.
One thing that certainly many religious groups can all agree on is their hatred of gays and lesbians. And
but the thing is, though, too, they base this stuff on the Bible, but the Bible has a lot of crazy laws that these Christians don't care about, because it's not illegal. Like, if it was illegal to eat lobster in the States, you know what I mean? People wouldn't necessarily be eating it, and they'd be like, don't eat that vile, vile thing. But because it is legal, they don't care. And so I'm just saying, like, if it's, I'd say it's almost more about in our society about culture than it is about religion.
And I think that's one of the things that I find troubling about religion in general, and it's one of the reasons why I am a non-believer, why I am an atheist, is that you can use religion to justify anything. You can use it to justify whatever it is you happen to believe, because there's no proving it. It's just the invisible people in the sky, and
everybody has to respect that.
And everybody has to just respect that. And I think one of the things that atheists are saying is, okay, religion is, it's a hypothesis about the world. It's an idea about how the world works and why it is the way it is. Prove it. Show us some evidence. You know, let's treat it like any other idea about the world. Let's treat it like any other idea about why we are the way we are, how things work. Let's just talk about it, and let's stop treating it like it's a special thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's an idea, though. Mm-hmm. I think most religious documents and texts, where, regardless of where you came from, were formed a long time ago. And mm-hmm, I think our concepts of sexuality are a recent modern development. You're having basically new things coming into conflict with the old. And I never understand why, like, religious groups, or maybe the Amish are one of them, who speak out against technology because it's something new that's come to us.
Well, exactly. And I think, again, it's like a lot of religion is based on these, it's very, very old, you know, certainly Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism, those are the big five. In the world at large, you know, they are very old. They are based on very old texts, and people are trying to interpret those texts in a modern world with modern knowledge. And so, of course, what they do is cherry pick. And this is the funny thing: is like even the fundamentalists, even the people who claim that they believe in the literal interpretation
right.
of the Bible. They don't. There's all kinds of religious injunctions in the Bible that they don't pay any attention
to. And they love...
What about not eating lobster and not blending cotton with linen? And it's crazy.
And
you know, so what it is that you can use religion to defend whatever it is you believe. If you believe that gays are disgusting, you can really use religion to defend that. If you believe that homosexuality is beautiful and natural, you can use religion to defend that.
Hence the gay Jesus.
Exactly, yes.
Or black Jesus. But you know one thing I never see is a Hispanic Jesus.
Jesus.
Well, you see guys named Jesus, but you never see, like the Mexicans have the Virgin or the Guadalupe, but you never see like a
That's
Chicano
not true.
Jesus.
I've seen when I was in Peru, they had
you
Jesus.
Have?
Yes, Jesus was at the last.
As an Aztec.
Jesus in Peru, they don't have Aztecs there. Those are Inca.
Incan Jesus.
But Jesus is sitting there. It's the Last Supper and he's eating cuy, which is their like national food, which is actually guinea pig. So the Last Supper, he's eating a guinea pig and he's drinking something called a chicha, which is like a corn drink instead of wine.
But is it wrong to believe in mythology? I mean, it's like maybe, you know, I always see religion as sort of a grown-up version of Santa Claus. You know, that it makes us feel good and everybody's sort of like, there's some people in the group that know that it's just a big lie, but we sort of continue this tradition because it brings comfort and stability into our weak little human brains.
Well, and why do people feel so bad? Why do people feel so threatened when that stuff gets challenged?
When it's threatened.
Because you don't have anything else.
Well, but see, this is the thing, is that I think that we do have something else. And I think that this is one of the big myths about atheism is that a life without a belief in God is just hopeless. It's meaningless. There's no basis. There's no basis for morality. You know,
the premise of Planet of the Apes.
I'm sorry?
And that was the same premise of the Planet of the Apes movie.
Right.
Whereas, like, they knew that humans apes had evolved from humans and humans were connected, but they thought if we told the public the truth, everything would go apeshit, literally.
Then it would fall apart.
Well, Greta,
see, here's the thing. To answer your question, you asked about what's the harm. And it depends a little bit on the specific religion. You know, certainly if all you're doing is going to the MCC and you're, you know, you don't, you know, you're just using your religion to inspire you to be a good person in the world. That's not hugely harmful, but essentially there's a theory in data processing and computers called garbage in, garbage out. And that's that if you have a mistaken idea then you're going to come up with mistaken ideas. And I think that this is something we see with religion, is that if you have a that I do think religion is... Ultimately, it's a mistaken idea about the world. I don't think it's stupid. You know, obviously lots of very intelligent people believe in it, but I think it's mistaken, and I do think it leads people to make bad decisions. People make decisions based on the idea that they're going to have an afterlife. They make decisions based on the idea that they're going to get reincarnated or that they're going to go to heaven.
Or they waste the planet because the end of time is coming.
They waste the planet because the end of time is coming, exactly. There's all sorts of ways that, you know, if you have a mistaken idea about the world, it's going to lead you to make bad decisions. And
right.
I could list from here to Texas and back the kinds of bad decisions people make based on religion. You know, people don't take their kids to doctors because they think that God is going to heal them, you know, or they, you know, try to pass laws against same-sex marriage.
But on the other hand, do they do good things because of religion?
I'm sorry, say it again?
But on the other hand, do they do a lot of good things based on religion?
Some people do some good things based on religion, too. The question is, what would people do if they didn't believe in religion?
Would they still do those good things?
Would they still do those good things? Would they still do those bad things? And I think some of the cases, of course they would. You know, good people...
But I think we have this cynical viewpoint that we don't trust humanity collectively without manipulation. And I would argue that the rise of blogs and the whole internet is sort of like a selfless enterprise in and of itself. I mean, that you do have people creating a lot of content, but also a lot of structure and software for this animal that the internet is. That and you could use the internet as an argument that actually atheism does work collectively, and you don't have to force religion upon humanity.
Well, you know what a really good argument for that? I agree with you that, you know, obviously the blogosphere works and the internet works, and it doesn't have to have a single, you know, dominating authority to make it work. The best example I have is Europe. there are plenty of countries in Europe, the United Kingdom, England, France, the Scandinavian countries, Holland, where roughly half or even more of the population are non-believers. And they work fine. They work better than we do in a lot of ways. You know, they're not killing each other in the streets. They're not, you know, looting. There's not rioting. They actually treat each other very well, and they have a very highly advanced sense of morality and social responsibility. And I think that's one of the things that that you see in a lot of atheists, is that atheists think this world is all we have. This life is it. There's nothing else, so we really better make it work. We better make it good. And we better make it good for each other and not just for ourselves. Because that other guy on the street, he only has this one life. You know, I want to make it as good for him as possible as well as for me. And I think that that's, you know, there are societies, you know, relatively recent, granted, the rise of secularism in Europe is relatively recent, but they do okay. And so I think that that's a big counter-argument to the idea that you have to have religion in order to have morality, and that you have to have religion in order to have comfort and happiness. You know, they do pretty well in Europe. They have good lives.
They sure do. Now, you on your blog, Greta Christina's blog, it's gretachristina.com. You have a section on your blog that
says... I'm going to interrupt you. It's gretachristina.typepad.com.
Okay. Bro, you got to... But you...
No one's going to remember that.
I got that right.
Doesn't it redirect?
It does redirect. Your main site...
GretaChristina.com is my website, and that's different.
Oh,
yeah, but,
okay.
But on your website, you have a big button that says read her blog.
That's okay. True. That's
so,
true.
But the blog is GretaChristina.typepad.com.
Right.
So,
Tilde.
Tilde.
Enya. Al Jazeera.
But you have a section on your blog that says, if you were going to read three things. Now, the first two things, so these are articles you want people to read if they're going to read anything. So
right.
The first two are about atheism, and then the last one that you have is about sex.
That's
so the first one about atheism is, why are atheists so angry? So why are atheists so angry?
Well, that's a good question. And the reason I wrote that piece was...
That's your questions.
There's a trope in...
What a brilliant question you just asked me,
Brilliant question you just asked. I'm so glad you asked that. Is it one of the sort of common criticisms against the sort of newly vocal, newly visible, newly cranky atheist community is, you know, why are you so angry? It's like you must just be unhappy. You must just be miserable, depressed people, and you're just griping. And what I wanted to write about was atheists are angry because atheists have reason to be angry. You know, atheists are angry because religion has done terrible things in the world. It's done terrible. It's responsible for terrible things against atheists, and it's responsible for terrible things against other people, against each other. You know, religious oppression of other religions is, you know, millennia old.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get out the idea and to think that this happens with almost any time a social justice movement starts to get going, when the gay movement was relatively new, when the civil rights movement for African Americans was relatively new, when the feminist movement was relatively new. People said, why are you so angry? You know, it's like you're just screaming and yelling and, you know, that's not going to help. And I wanted to write an explanation of, you know, this is why we're angry.
So basically you're comparing atheists to angry lesbians in the 70s.
Exactly. Absolutely. And, you know, angry lesbians in the 70s, boy, A, they had reason to be angry, and B, they got stuff done.
They sure did, didn't they?
So are you comparing, are you saying that you're the Gloria Steinem of atheism?
Well, I'm not going to single myself out that way, but I do think that there are a lot of parallels between the atheist movement now and the lesbian, gay, bi, trans movement, say, in the late 60s and early 70s, post-Stonewall.
Well,
I see a lot of parallels. It's very interesting.
What does the atheist movement want to accomplish?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. That's a very good question, because that depends a little bit on which atheist you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
There are some atheists who really just, they kind of live and let live. They would be perfectly happy for religious believers to go on believing what they believe as long as they get it out of their face, as long as they get it out of the public schools, they get it out of government, they get it out of public policy, you know, they stop executing adulteresses and, you know, cutting off girls' clitorises,
right,
and, you know, doing all that, you know, bombing buildings and dropping, you know, bombing cities and all the terrible stuff that happens. They're like, you know, just stop trying to force religion down other people's throats and we'll be fine. There are other atheists, and I actually count myself among this, who, in addition to that, are trying to persuade people to not believe in religion anymore, who are trying to say, let's talk about religion. We really don't think this is an accurate idea. We think it's a mistaken idea. Mm-hmm. We would like for people to not believe it. Now, I don't know any atheists who are trying to do this by
I want to see a billboard that says that.
Exactly. You know, they're putting up billboards or putting up blogs or writing books. We're certainly not trying to pass laws or make religion illegal or anything like that. But, you know, we hope that eventually over time religion will disappear from the public consciousness. But the main thing for most atheists is the first one. Just believe what you want to believe. We don't really care that much. We think you're wrong, but we don't care. But just don't try to make it public policy.
What is it about religious people that makes them want to shove their religion down your throat?
Well, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands.
You know? There's a very good book that talks about that. Daniel Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, talks about that exact question. Mm-hmm. It's a book about how religion developed, you know, historically and psychologically, and, you know, what function it serves. And one of the points that he makes is that the very fact that you can't prove religion, the very fact that it's invisible gods, invisible spirits, invisible souls, invisible angels, you can't see any of it, you can't prove any of it, the afterlife happens after you die and nobody can provide any evidence for it, that there's this paradox in human thinking, which is that if you can't prove something, you cling to it all the more tightly and you defend it all the more fiercely. Because, you know, if somebody came over the hill and said, the sky is orange, well, you wouldn't feel a compelling need to try to kill them because they said that. You just look at the sky is blue, they're insane, you don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. But when they come over the hill and say, God is Allah instead of God is Jesus, or vice versa, you can't really prove your point, and yet you've built your whole life around it. And so people feel this compelling need to really ferociously defend it exactly because they can't prove it.
Now, I mean, do you really think that most religious people, most people who identify under a religion, just to be real clear here, are literalists? Because I would say that the existence of these paintings of Black Jesus illustrate the fact that we think of Jesus and we think of our religions as more metaphor than literal.
Well, I'm not sure it's so much that shows that people think of it metaphorically as
may they not
literally.
Be as aware that they're actually thinking of it as a metaphor.
It's more that religion is very malleable. People will, you know, change religion in order to fit the needs of their society or just themselves personally. But that doesn't mean that they don't believe it ferociously. Mm-hmm. I mean, people will, you know, religion obviously alters and it mutates and it takes on different forms and varieties, but people still hang on to those varieties very strongly.
Isn't, though, I think of atheists and agnostics and none of the above and all the above, they all are trying to answer three questions, which is, who are we, where are we going, and where we have been?
Right.
And if we come together under trying to answer those questions, does really the labels of spirituality and religion, does that really even matter? You know, because one of the most popular podcasts, the categories there are, is spirituality. And so I would say that a lot of people are still trying to answer these core fundamental questions because their religions don't really do a very good job of answering them.
I think that's true. And you know, I think that one of the things that I found that's interesting when I started reading atheist and humanist and secularist writing is a lot of it is argument against religion, and I do that a certain amount of myself, but a lot of it is also those exact questions. Who are we? Why are we here? Where do we come from? And, you know, most non-believers answer those questions in very naturalistic ways. You know, we're products of evolution, you know, and, you know, we're animals, we crawled out of the sea, and, you know, we're this particular life form, and the meaning of our life is whatever we create. And now, we create meaning of life, but that doesn't make it not meaningful. It just means that it's not handed down to us from somebody else. It's something that we're responsible for.
And that kind of leads us to the next essay, because of the three things that people should read on your blog is another one that was originally published in the Skeptical Inquirer magazine, and it is titled Comforting Thoughts About Death That Have Nothing to Do with God. And in it, you describe how people, you know, believe in God because they want comfort for an afterlife, mm-hmm. or it gives their life meaning. So, and that death is just very, very frightening to people. So how does an atheist handle the frightening, the scariness of death?
That's a lot of different atheists have different approaches to that. The first thing I would want to say is that that was...
Well, maybe I should
that,
say, how do you handle
how
it?
How do I? Now? Well, see, that's the thing is that that was the thing that really stopped me for a long time from letting go of my religious beliefs, my spiritual beliefs, was that I was terrified of the thought that when I die, I'm just going to die and I'm going to be gone and that's it. But I have found ways to find comfort. One of them is the idea that, you know, life is change, and when you and that change involves letting go of things, and you can't hang on to any one particular perfect moment. You know, our very consciousness is, you know, rooted in the idea of moving forward, and that, you know, the alternative, you know, to death is... You know, let me put it this way. I've never read a description of an afterlife that sounded appealing.
The Elysian Fields didn't turn you on?
You sing in heaven for, you know, 20 billion years. You sing the praises of God. I mean, God, how tedious. I'm sorry, but...
But there's people out there that say that heaven is beyond your capability as a human being to understand it.
Well, of course, it's going to be, you know, very vague.
Well, exactly. It's very vague, but sort of like you say, well, if it's beyond my capability to understand it, then when I'm experiencing, I'm not going to be me.
Mm-hmm. I like what Laurie Anderson said. She says, paradise is exactly like it is right now, only much, much better.
Much better, exactly.
So you're saying that life is beautiful and you enjoy it because it's a finite thing.
Exactly. It's part of the nature of it is that it's finite. I actually wrote another piece on my blog talking about the idea of death as a deadline. And I'm a very deadline-driven person. Mm-hmm. I don't get anything done unless I know it's got to get done by this time. And
you're a procrastinator.
I'm a procrastinator. But if I know, but I'm also very good at my deadlines, and mm-hmm. if I know that this has to be done by a certain time, I do it. And for me, the idea of death is a deadline. It's what tells me, you know, I can't just sit around watching Law & Order reruns for the rest of my life.
You could be developing some very sharp investigative skills, my friend.
I love Law & Order.
Well, you know, there's some value to that, but, you know, but it's like, if I want to get stuff done, I've got to get it done now.
Anytime I deal with the police, I'm always like, look, I've watched Law & Order. You can't pull that one on me. Now, let's examine some religious cliches, okay? Mm-hmm. You always hear this phrase, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual.
Right.
Why are people trying to pull that bullshit over me? I mean, can we ban that phrase from being ever uttered again? It's like, look, you're either religious or you're not. You know,
well, I think
spirituality
is
the same thing.
What people are trying to say there is they don't belong to an organized religion. They hate a lot of the things that organized religion is connected with, but they still have some sort of metaphysical belief. And I think that some of where that comes from is that we do have this idea very deeply rooted that to not be spiritual is to be a bad person, that to not be spiritual means that you're selfish, you're purely materialistic, you don't care about, you know, love, you don't care about transcendence, you don't care about a feeling of connection with the world, that it's this very lonely, isolated life. And so people say, well, I'm not religious, but I'm very spiritual. And sometimes it means just literally they believe in metaphysical mm-hmm. spirits and chakras and energy or whatever. But sometimes it just means that they don't want to say, I'm not spiritual, because they think that that means that they're cut off from something. And you know, all I can say
or
to that is
that
I don't
person.
Experience that. You know, it's like I'm an atheist. I am not a spiritual person. And I do experience a sense of great transcendent connection.
Well, do you ever have a sense of mystery and awe in the fact that the universe is so old, or that the chance of life that arose on this planet is circumstantial?
Absolutely. I mean, see, this is the thing is people tend to see, I'm a big science nerd. I love reading about science. And a lot of people tend to see science as very cold and boring. I think science is fascinating, and I think it's awe-inspiring. I mean, the vastness of the universe and the fact that, to me, the idea that out of just physical stuff, out of water and rocks and sunlight, life evolved, and not just life, but consciousness, that we evolved with our capacity for joy and reason and understanding.
And then come up with mythology.
And come up with all these stories and art and everything. It's like, that's amazing to me.
And then we can, life can arise to then change the mechanics on how
it
life
actually arose.
Exactly. That's astonishing. You know,
now, we recommend that people, if you're interested in reading more about this, obviously you can go to GretaChristina.com and check on her blog, but I also recommend our listeners check out The Demon Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. This was written by Carl Sagan in his last years of his life as he was dying from cancer, and also Billions and Billions, Thoughts on Life and Death at the Brink of Millennium, also by Carl Sagan. Usually we think of Carl Sagan as somebody who wrote a lot about astronomy and popularizing science, but he also wrote a lot about living life outside of religion. What are some of the books that you find exciting or interesting? What is your Bible, Greta?
Well, I definitely don't have a Bible because it's one of the
that gives you comfort and inspiration.
She got the joke. Okay. She got the joke.
You know, honestly, a lot of what I read in that department is blogs, is other blogs. There's a wonderful blog that I read a lot called Daylight Atheism. And he, the writer of that blog, writes a lot about these kinds of things that we're talking about. Is like, what does life mean without God? You know, mm-hmm. what is morality without God? What is joy without God? You know, how do we accept death without God? You know, what is our place in the world? You know, there's other blogs. There's a wonderful blog called Friendly Atheist that talks a lot about how can atheists get along with religious believers. A lot of where I get my inspiration from is books about science and books about evolution, especially, and neuropsychology, I think, is just fascinating. All this stuff about how the mind works, mm-hmm. I'm just constantly inspired by that. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's just fascinating to think that thought just comes out of, you know, this mushy stuff in your skull. You know, that never stops impressing me.
Okay, Greta. And so the third item on your blog that you write about that says, you know, the three things you have to read is about sex, because you write or edit a lot of material about sex and lots of books and stuff like that.
I do.
And so the third one was, are we having sex now or what? So how do you qualify sex? What counts as sex? Is it blowjobs? Is it anal?
Well, you know, that's the whole topic of that piece is about how sex is actually very hard to define. It's very hard to define what it means to have sex with somebody. When I first started having sex, I'm bisexual, and when I first started mm-hmm. having sex, I was mostly having sex with men. And I pretty much defined it the standard way, you know. Is it okay to say the F word on...
You can say anything you want.
Okay. I defined it as fucking. Mm-hmm. but then I started having sex with women.
Uh-huh.
And boy, when you're a woman and you start having sex with women, you sure have to change your definition of what sex is.
I know, because I know, like...
It's not the penis going in the vagina, because there's...
It's about making tacos and tamales and tortillas.
Because I know a lot of gay guys who's like, well, we didn't have sex. I'm like, you blew him. And they're like, well, that's not really sex. I'm just
okay,
like...
Wait a minute. Say that again. Gay guys are saying that blowjobs aren't
yeah.
sex?
Yeah, I've heard lots of guys. It depends, because I think we all qualify what is sex, because like a lot of guys are like, they think sex is it's penetration or...
Anal,
like,
intercourse.
And then there's lots of people, it's like, if they're not getting fucked, then that's not sex.
It
didn't happen. And they're very, I know a lot of bottoms that get very disappointed. Like, yeah, he'd blow me, but he would
Let
fuck.
Me just mm-hmm. jump on in before we move on. Uh-huh. Our guest today is Greta Christina. She's the author of her blog on TypePad, Greta Christina. And you can learn more about her at GretaChristina.com. I want to remind listeners that she has a fabulous book called Paying for It, mm-hmm. which is a guide by sex workers for their clients. And she's talking to us about atheism mm-hmm. and religion on today's show.
And sex and her sex books. So speaking of your book, Paying for It, uh-huh. do we really need a book on how to treat a hooker? Can't we just like come and go?
Well, here's the thing about that uh-huh. the book is if all you want is an orgasm, then you don't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about sex work is that sex workers are like any other professional service providers. They will treat you better if they like you. Mm-hmm. And that's true of the person who gives you coffee at your coffee shop. It's true of your car mechanic. It's true of pretty much anybody who provides, it's true of your massage therapist, and it's true of your sex worker. If they like you, they're going to give you a better time.
So what does it take to find that hooker with the heart of gold?
and that it will make me pancakes the next day.
Well, they may not make you pancakes the next day unless you pay them to do that. And, you know, there are people who provide the girlfriend experience or the boyfriend experience where they actually date you and go out to dinner with you and whatever. Basically, you need, and there's a whole long list in the book of, mm-hmm. that's why I wrote a book, is essentially you need to treat sex workers with courtesy and respect. You need to not try to push them to do things that they don't like to do. You need to not try to bargain them down from what they say their prices are. You need to
You can't haggle with a hooker?
I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Is that just a Western? Because, like, you know, in Europe, everybody haggles over prices. You go to the market in mm-hmm. or the Middle East. So I don't know. Is it
an American thing to be like, okay, $400 for the first hour, and then if you actually want me to take my clothes off, it's another $100. And then
handles extra.
Well, here's the thing about it is that some sex workers will let you bargain, but you're not going to have as good a time with them as if you just either accepted their price or said, you know, I can't afford that. I'm going to go find somebody who costs $200. Mm. Because it's a little more personal than that. You're basically saying you're not worth it. If they say, you know, for me an hour is $300, and they say, nah, you're not mm-hmm. you're not worth that.
Well, like let's I know a hooker,
$200. They're going to take that really personally, and they may agree to it, but then they're going to go, okay, well, you think I'm not worth $300? I'm not going to give you a $300 time. You know, I'm going to.
So you get what you pay for.
You get what you pay for.
So is that true in all the relationships of freelancers? Because you work as a freelance writer,
mm-hmm.
And you've also worked as a dancer.
Yes.
At a club, what can we learn as freelance employees from looking at the relationship of sex workers and their clients?
Well, it's a similar thing. I mean, you know, I'm certainly speaking as a writer. I write better when I'm well paid. And I write better when I'm paid on time. Here's this publishers, if you don't pay writers on time, they're going to get very cranky and they're not going to write for you as well. It's very similar. It's you know, if you treat me with respect, if you occasionally give me compliments and say, hey, I like your work, this was a really good piece this week, I'm going to do a better job for you mm-hmm. than if you just...
Well, Greta, I'm certainly enjoying this interview very much.
And we didn't pay anything for it.
Well, that's true. Yeah,
well, we're paying in our mindfulness.
And our mindfulness and our,
exactly.
and our thoughtfulness.
Exactly. No, I'm enjoying this tremendously.
Yes.
But if paying for sex wasn't so expensive, do you think more people would do it? Like, I know I go to these websites, rentboy.com, because I'm nosy. Mm-hmm. I want to know who's hooking in Chicago.
And we know who's hooking in Chicago.
I know who's hooking in Chicago. And some of it, I start seeing my friends up there.
That's interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to bring it up to them because I know that they're sort of like uncomfortable about talking about it. And it's also that they use like alternate names.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Like when I'll tell the listeners, I used to work as an escort and I made the mistake, or I don't know whether the mistake, I used my own name.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a drag queen, I also used my own name. Or sometimes a feminized version of it, but people never believed that Fausto really was me, and I was just going to their house, and I was trying to basically get away with it.
Uh-huh.
if sex wasn't so expensive, would more people do it? Because I'm wondering if I always when I explain hooking to somebody, they go, well, I would never do that. But I said, well, have you bought a guy dinner? Have you bought him a beer to try to get to know him, better?
Is that the same, though, Greta, to buy somebody a beer as to actually pay them outright?
It's a gray line. I think that there is something of a difference between, you know, taking somebody out to dinner in hopes that they'll have sex with you and actually paying them. But it's a gray area. I mean, certainly there's, you know, the long history of... your sugar daddies and sugar mamas and that sort of thing. To answer the first question, I know I would probably pay for sex if it weren't so expensive. You know, it's like you know, I actually wrote a piece about this on my blog. Mm-hmm. I did once
micropayments for micro orgasms.
Yes. You know, I did once actually go to see a professional submissive. It was partly out of professional curiosity. I'd written this book and I wanted to see, okay, what is it really like to be a customer? And so I went, I paid a professional submissive and I really enjoyed the experience, but it's $300. I'm a freelance writer. I don't have $300.
So you dominate.
If I had $300, I'd be spending it on shoes. I wouldn't be spending it on, you know, sex work. But if it were less expensive, yes. But I think that that's part of what makes it expensive is because a lot of people don't want to do it. There's a stigma against it, and people don't want to go into it. And one of the things that a lot of sex workers that I've talked to have said, and this is, I think, is really interesting, is that in places where the stigma is going down, like in the big cities like London and San Francisco and New York, where there is less of a stigma on sex work, prices are dropping. More people are getting into the industry and saying, hey, sure, I'll be a sex worker for a while. Why the hell not? And so prices are going down, and it's creating a problem for people who've been doing it for a while.
So being a titty dancer, is it just like the movie Showgirls?
Well, see, here's the thing.
Well, I worked in a peep show.
I didn't work at a place where it was like lap dances and in a club. I worked in a peep show where it was behind glass.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a whole different scene. I actually got an hourly wage. I got paychecks with an hourly wage. It wasn't tips or anything like that.
They didn't put tips through a little slot or anything?
Not the place where I worked. You could do that if you did the talk to a live nude girl booth, then you were working for tips. But if you were just working the main show, you danced on a stage, mm-hmm. and it was a place where people put quarters in, and the window went up, and you look at the girls on the stage. And
With that peep show booth thing kind of thing, because that to me that kind of epitomizes me, kind of like, I guess the word would be like the most tawdry kind of show. Because it has
what
a very
tawdry.
Tawdry. Well, what's the word? It kind
tacky.
Of
tacky.
Cheap. Guess, no.
Floozy.
There's something about it though, because like a little curtain goes up, right, and then they kind of watch you and you do your thing. It has it kind of almost like a tawdry but yet romantic kind of feel to it, because nostalgic, because it's something you don't really see too often anymore, because like, you know, they've got these huge giant strip clubs where there's you know 30 different poles, but back in the day, you know, it was a kind of, or maybe like intimate experience.
I'm not really quite sure how to answer that. I mean, certainly, you know, I'm not going to say it was the classiest joint in the world, but one of the things I thought was interesting is, and that I hadn't really expected when I started doing the work, is the dancers, smart, interesting women. A lot of them were students. A lot of them were artists. You know, with the number of grad students who go into sex work, it's
I'm writing my thesis.
I know. How many people have like used their thesis as an excuse to be sluts?
Well, you know, maybe it works that way too. But
do you think we need permissions to open up and to let go of inhibitions? And sometimes a beer is just not enough.
Yeah. You know, it's like I need to pay for my college, so.
So you do that,
but when you're paying for sex, I mean, that you're saying that there's should be nothing wrong with that, but isn't there a shadow belief that there's this wantonness that's not being taken into consideration, that I have to pay for sex, or I want to pay for sex because nobody really wants to have sex with me?
Well, I think that that's certainly a common belief. I don't think it's necessarily warranted. I mean, a comparison I make sometimes is, you don't think that there's anything terrible if you pay somebody to cook you a meal, if you go out to a restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, it's even if you cook it for yourself most of the time, or you and your partner, you know, you have people who cook for you.
What if my husband is a terrible cook?
Well, I bet you go out to dinner a certain amount.
Ooh.
So, you know, I think that people, you know, if you pay, I don't see a huge difference between paying somebody to cook you a meal and paying for sex.
If you eat out a lot, you're going to get a meal that's made for you with a lot more sodium and fat, because the person making that meal for you doesn't have as much of an emotional investment in your well-being.
Well, that depends on where you eat out. And you have to be, I think that if you're somebody who sees a lot of sex workers, you're probably more selective about who you see. And there's kind of a myth that sex workers don't care about their customers, and that they're just, and I'm sure that's true for some sex workers, maybe even a lot of them. But when I was editing this book is an anthology of writings by sex workers, a lot of them really liked their customers, or at least they liked some of their customers, and they enjoyed them.
They're people persons.
They enjoyed their company, they enjoyed having sex with them, you know, and it's, you know, there's no more, you know, and same thing with restaurants. Some people really enjoy restaurant work, and they care about, you know, providing the best meal that they can for you.
Now, when you worked as a stripper, which kind of customers made you mad or feel good about yourself or feel bad?
Well, let's see. The ones who I liked were the ones who were really interacting with me. They were giving something back. They would smile. There was through glass.
They would say that you were really pretty.
They would compliment you. They would say that you were pretty. They would say that I was sexy. One guy, because you can't really talk very well because it's through glass. Mm-hmm. One guy brought a notebook, and he wrote things and held them up to the glass to say, "You're beautiful, you're sexy, I really like you." You know, they sort of be flirtatious. Mm-hmm. One guy came into the booth, and he would dance. You know,
really?
And that was just really sweet. Or the guys who, like, I loved the guys who would come in and wear... It's like the guys who are wearing, like, the garter belt and bra.
I love it.
And they come in on a break, you know,
tell me more about that.
District. And you know, and I loved that. That was just because they were giving something back.
Now, they would jerk off while you danced?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And not all of them, but a lot of them.
That See, I always tell this to gay men. It's like, you'll get really far with a hot stripper. Mm-hmm. With a male dancer, you know, you don't always have to give them a lot of money. If you just got, because I come from it from a performer's background, and I say, you dance so well, you're so attractive, you're so charming, and they usually like, they're happy with me giving them one. There's this one dancer here in Chicago, his name is Luciano, and he thinks I'm his best friend. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of weird because he thinks one day I'm going to like spend $500 to have sex with him or something.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I see him, I'm always like, you look fantastic. You're dancing so well. And he's just like really happy that I'm giving him like some praise.
Exactly. You know, it's like you're treating
even
him
though
like
it's obvious,
and,
though, because yeah, he's like one of the most attractive people that you would ever see in the world next to my husband. But he's up on the stage and he's really like working hard to connect with an audience.
Yes.
And this audience is like, well, he has a superiority of being a very attractive person.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to a lot of people, it's like, look, if you just smile and you say how fabulous you are, usually a lot of these people with low self-esteem, they'll take that as a tip.
Not even people with low self-esteem. And I mean, I didn't have low self-esteem
I'm just
when I worked
kidding.
As a stripper. I liked the work. I thought highly of myself, but certainly it doesn't hurt to have people smile at you and say that you're beautiful and... you know, yeah, no, that goes a huge way. And you're right that it's even if all you're trying to do is save a buck, you know, that can go a long way. I mean, I would rather have somebody, strippers are working and, you know, a big part of what, you know, I talk about in the book, Paying for It, is, tip, you know, be a good tipper. That helps. Be a good tipper, be a consistent tipper. Don't try to, you know, like I say, dicker people down from their prices, because that just sets up a bad relationship, a bad vibe. But yeah, no, it goes a huge way to just say you're beautiful. I love the way you dance.
Oh. Now, Greta, you're also the editor of Best Erotic Comics 2008, which smashes the divide between literary and art comics and adult comics by including both the hottest work from the literary art comics world and the highest quality work from the adult comics world. So are you a big comic fan? How did you get into this, or how did you become the editor for this erotic comic series?
Well, I'm a pretty big comics fan. I'm not like somebody who, like, you know, obsessively read comic books as a kid, and you know, it wasn't like that. But I've always enjoyed comics. I came at this more at the Best Erotic Comics book a little bit more from the erotic perspective, because I've always been a sex writer, a sex editor.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been an appreciator of erotica, mm-hmm. not just writing, but of comics and photos and videos and everything like that. And a few years ago, I started working for a company called Last Gasp,
right.
which is the publisher of this book, and they are a comics publisher, among other things. They're the ones who published Robert Crumb back in the 70s, and you know, they've been around alternative comics. That's a big part of their world and what mm-hmm. they do. And I'd always been aware of comics, I'd always read comics, but when I started working for Last Gasp, I was exposed to this world in a much broader way.
So what makes a good erotic comic? Because as editor, you had to pick and choose, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what makes a hot erotic comic?
Well, the thing that's interesting about comics is, of course, it's both words and pictures. Mm-hmm. And it has to be a good story, and it has to be good art. And the story and the art have to really work together.
Was there anything too outrageous that didn't make the cut? Like, was you like, oh, we can't feature that?
I didn't put any... there was nothing that I kept out because it was too outrageous. There was a couple of things that I had to say no to because they featured people who are underage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, of course, legal restrictions about that.
Right.
But other than that, no. It's if I don't know if you've seen the book, but there's stuff in this book that's very outrageous indeed.
One of my favorite erotic comics is where Godzilla and King Kong are, like, fighting downtown.
Yes.
Have you seen that one?
I love that one. That's one of my very favorite pieces. And the thing that's funny about that, it's gay monster. It's gay monsters. It's gay Godzilla, gay King Kong. They're
right.
fighting in the streets, but then they start having sex, and they're using like an oil rig for lube, and it's
hot.
And it's hilarious.
Very sweet. And there's a scene at the end where they're spooning. And the thing that's hilarious about that is everybody loves that. Straight men love that comic. Because they're Godzilla fans, and they're like, mm-hmm. oh, that's so cute, Godzilla and King Kong, that's so sweet. And it's that comic cuts across gender and sexual preference lines like nothing else.
So mm-hmm. so I could bag a straight guy by saying, you know, you and me will be like King Kong and Godzilla.
You can try.
And I think in the comic they actually use like a circus tent as a condom or something like
really?
That. I can't remember what it was very
well, I'm
mindful.
Glad they practice safe sex.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know what you're going to get from Godzilla.
You sure
exactly,
don't.
Yeah.
He's been around for a long, long time.
And all that texture on his skin, that could be an
you're
STD.
Like, what is that? So also you wrote a novella called Bending It, which portrays a young woman who can't seem to find an alternate sexual position. And she's having a hard time becoming a submissive.
It's not that exactly. It's that it's the story is about a woman who is sexually obsessed is a strong word. It's not mm-hmm. a very nice word, but she's very, very interested in, let's say.
So it's your life story.
Being bent over. this is what she likes. All she likes is sex when she's bent over.
Okay.
She likes it from behind, and that's all she wants. And she has sort of in the beginning part of the story, she's going through the series of lovers who are just, They don't really get it. That's you know, and they kind of look down on her because she's so fixated.
Mm-hmm.
And then she finds another woman who is as into doing her from behind as she's into being done from behind. And it takes it from there. And I don't want to give too much of the
okay,
story
sure.
away.
Okay, sure. No,
but,
no, not at all.
But it's not so much about she's having a hard time being submissive is that she's very fixated on this one mm-hmm. sort of form of sex. And it's sort of about what happened. The point of the story, other than just, you know, dirty sex, which
mm-hmm.
is a lot of the point of the story, is what happens when you get the thing that you most want. You know,
okay.
is, you know, what do you do then?
What's after that?
What's after that?
You have to come up with a new dream.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's sort of what happened. What happens to this woman, I don't want to give too much away, but what
sure.
happens is what she wants starts to change. And she's sort of centered, and that's hard for her because she centered her whole erotic life on this one fetish. And then as she starts getting interested in other things, it sort of changes her whole sense of who she is.
So she grows and develops.
And also it kind of screws up her relationship.
Okay.
Greta, in the introduction to Paying for It,
mm-hmm.
the collection of the Guide for Sex Workers and Their Clients,
uh-huh.
you're sort of talking about that a lot of relationships are always an exchange, even romantic ones. But isn't love about giving and expecting nothing? So what is love?
You want me to tell you what love is? I don't know what love is.
That's a very open-ended question.
I don't think love is about giving and expecting nothing. I think that's being a doormat. I think that's a really bad idea to give and expect nothing. I've been in a really happy relationship for, 11 years. We're coming up on our anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you get married?
I'm sorry?
Did you get married?
We did get married 3 times now. We've been married. But I think that I don't know how to define love, but I don't think that it's just about giving. I mean, I do think that a love relationship is different from a sex worker, you know, the sex work relationship, or even, you know, from like just a picking somebody up in a bar relationship. You know, there is more selflessness, there's more willingness to say, okay, look, you've got a cold, I'll take care of the dinner for a week. But I think that if you don't expect some sort of return, then you're going to get walked on.
Okay.
Interesting. Well, Greta, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you
so much. Sorry, leaving us such a dark note.
But no, it was a joy. It was such a pleasure to talk to you about these topics of atheism, sex, and sex workers. And
so, once again, your book is Paying for It, A Guide for Sex Workers and Their Clients. And you also have Best Erotic Comics 2008 and Three Kinds of Asking for It. They're all available through our website, feastoffools.net. Or through your blog, gretachristina.typepad.com. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast. This was really fun.
Greta Christina lives in San Francisco with her wife, Ingrid. You can learn more about her through gretachristina.com. Or through her blog, gretachristina.typepad.com.
And I want to remind people that we can't do this show without your support, so please visit feastoffools.net, make a donation, buy a t-shirt. We count on you to make this show happen. Also, join us on our Facebook group. Just search Feast of Fools and you'll find us.
Yeah, and that way you can, do the whole social network thingy that we do so well. Remember to tell your friends about the Feast of Fools podcast and go to the iTunes Music Store and write a review if you like our show. Tell the rest of the world how fabulous Feast of Fools is. Spread the gospel, even if you're an atheist.
Wonderful. What are we listening to here, Fausto?
This is the music of Levi Christ. The song You Found Me from his album The Gospel According to Levi is available through our website, feastoffools.net. Support independent music. I'm Fausto Fernandez.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.